This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 296 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce co-host Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Hi. Well, as much as I would like to have been on the beach in Chicago today because it was 73 or something like that, I was kept inside at my desk working, and so since spring and or summer's here, I'm just really excited to be here.
But working for you, that means all aviation stuff, right?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a geek, can I tell you?
All right, well, we knew that. Our other geek co-host, David Vanderhoof, is off this week, unfortunately, so he won't be joining us, but we look forward to having David back next week. We'll try to soldier on without his expertise. But we do have a great guest. This week we have John Cudahy. Now, he's the president of the International Council of Air Shows. John, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks, Max. It's great to be with you and Rob this evening.
Well, it's great to have you. We understand that ICAS, it's been around for a while, right? Formed in 1967, I believe, to protect the interests of air show professionals in North America. Originally, I guess there were just six air show members, but it's probably quite a bit more now.
Yeah, started almost as a conversation between a few people who met in the Midwest and decided that there was enough common interest to form the organization. It's grown steadily since then, really.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that in some more detail coming up. First, though, we have some aviation news, including things like why oil prices are actually good for airlines. Also, the U.S. has approved the F-35 flights to the U.K. for air shows in July. We'll talk about that. And we also see some feedback from Spirit Airlines CEO Ben Baldanza about the story we reported on last week. And we have a few other things to talk about there as well. As we mentioned, David's off, so no airplane of the week this time. He'll pick that up next week. We do have an Australia Desk report. It's a bit different. Steve and ATC Ben host the segment from the cockpit of a Cirrus SR20. And then Grant drops in with a quick report from on board his hot air balloon at 1,500 feet. So can't wait to hear that. And then we have Rob's Aviation Minute. Rob, what are we talking about this week?
Well, Max, this week I'm talking about the TSA. And I ran into them again on a trip to San Diego last week for a Flight Safety Foundation safety conference.
And then for the Across the Pond segment, well, Peter Johnson is also off this week. So no Across the Pond segment. We'll have that again for you next week. And then finally, we have a few topics to talk about that have been raised by you, our listeners. All right, well, let's get started with the aviation news. Our first story comes from Fox News. Actually, this is an AP article. Why high oil prices are actually good for airlines. That's right, good for airlines. Well, we know that fuel represents a huge portion of total airline costs, more than a third. The article notes that 10 years ago, U.S. carriers consumed 18 billion gallons of fuel at a cost of about $25 billion. But last year, in 2013, U.S. carriers consumed 16 billion gallons of jet fuel. That's 2 billion gallons less. but at a cost of over $48 billion. So how could anyone say that high oil prices are good for airlines? Well, this article isn't saying airlines like high fuel prices. It's saying the high cost has been good for them. And this goodness comes from how the airlines have responded. They have some examples in the article, Rob, to describe how airlines have responded to high fuel costs, including they've examined their operations and lowered their cost structure. They've lowered seat capacity to increase yield. There's some other examples in there as
well.
Yeah,
like for the Boeing and the Airbus and the Embraer and the Bombardier folks, it means they've bought new airplanes.
That's right.
That guzzle less gas. And unless I missed it, the two differentiations in the prices, I don't – did it compare the $18 billion and the number of flight hours that were operated versus the $16 billion and the number of flight hours or anything like that?
No, but that would have been a great calculation because that would speak to the efficiency.
Exactly. And as much as they don't like making monthly payments on new airplanes, $2 billion is the difference between, you know, making money and not making money. And, of course, the airlines have been making money the last couple of years. And that's a good thing, despite high oil prices.
That's right. They've certainly learned that ancillary fees are a way to help boost profits.
What kind of fees were those?
Ancillary fees.
Ancillary fees. Ah, I see. So you can tell the difference between an East Coast guy and a Midwest guy.
That's right. You say
ancillary.
Like ancillary. What do you say?
Ancillary.
Ancillary. All right, so you can take your pick with whichever pronunciation you like. Another interesting item that the article brought out was that it's harder now for new airlines to enter the market compared to years ago. So basically, you've got stronger airlines on more solid financial footing. And so the point of this article is that's actually good for them. They've been forced to behave this way, the way they have, in because of the high oil prices, and that's led to a good, strong industry.
Yeah, I think I might be wrong. We'd have to get Richard Abelafia or one of those guys on, but I doubt we're going to be seeing lots of new airlines spring up that become national carriers, because in the old days they would just go grab half a dozen used MD-80s or something, or 737s, and just fly them around cheap and throw the gas in them. But I think those days are kind of gone because it's just too expensive to do that.
For sure. John, how about from the standpoint of air shows and air show performers? Has the increase in fuel prices really impacted that in any way?
Yeah, it has. And unfortunately, it's all been negative. The as you know, the fuel prices have been going up pretty steeply and for a good long while now. There is no sort of equal and opposite positive reaction. It's been an additional expense to an industry that really has limited ways of attracting additional revenue and therefore paying for that additional expense. It's meant that performers are spending more money to put fuel in their airplane to get from point A to point B. The air shows themselves typically have a contractual arrangement where they pay for a significant portion of those cross-country flights to and from the show, and so it's driven the cost to the shows up as well. So there really has not been that same kind of positive element to fuel increases in the air show industry.
I think coming up, we're going to talk some about military airshow performers. But so without getting too deep into that right now, how does it work with military performers? Does the government pay for the fuel, or do the airshow promoters pay for that? How does that work?
They do. Typically, both for the U.S. and the Canadian military, the military pays for the fuel, not the airshow.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. So it's just sort of for the commercial acts. That there may be some sharing between the performers and the air show itself, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. All right, let's jump ahead to our next topic. This is titled, An American Plane in Iran Explained by Tehran. This is kind of interesting. A U.S. registered Bombardier Challenger 600 business jet was spotted recently at Tehran's international airport. Now, of course, the United States has an embargo against Iran, so this fueled all kinds of speculation and intrigue about what was going on here. If you look in FlightAware and put the tail number in, it shows that this is owned by the Bank of Utah as a trustee. Well, Iran now says that this flight brought in a high-ranking delegation from Ghana, and the jet was in possession of the U.S., they said, and chartered by Ghana's presidency. Interesting. Rob, how does this work with business jets? Maybe it's the same as with commercial. Here is a bank that owns the plane, but it's operated by who knows? We don't really know necessarily.
Well, no, and that's one of the issues. I mean, as far as we know, the State Department has sanctions in place that says, you know, that you can't export technology, essentially, that the Iranians can essentially backwards engineer or anything like that, use of their own. But now, does that mean that there is an absolute restriction that says a U.S. N-registered airplane cannot fly to Tehran? Well, interestingly, I spent most of the day today between a couple of organizations, including the State Department, and I said, just show me where it says that, yes or no. And I could not get a complete answer out of anybody. So what I think is really interesting is that one of the people from the State Department said, well, it certainly fits the definition of not exporting technology, right? Because it's U.S. manufactured engines and Western avionics. And I said, so you're essentially saying that the lack of a good regulation that you can quote, we're just going to kind of go with that, huh? He said, well, yeah, I think so. But essentially, you know, there are these operations, of course, the charter airplanes all over the world, and they're using airplanes of all, you know, a variety of different registries. I mean, it's a bit like the ocean-going vessels that are registered in other countries as the flag carrier, and then they're actually being operated by or for another organization or another country. And so what it looks like to me from what this story is saying and what I was able to find out is that these charters do occur more often than we think. And that they just, you know, those darn airplane spotters at airports with their darn cameras, yeah. Nothing gets past those guys. And so this is probably not the first time. It's probably just the first time in a while that any of us were even aware that this was going on. And so my guess is that there are people in the State Department saying, what the heck is going on?
Yeah. From an export control standpoint, there's really two sets of regulations. There's ITAR, which is concerning military applications, and then there's the Export Administration Regulations, the EAR, I think, to which this might apply. But with either of those, depending on the technology and the situation, you may have to obtain an export license. And for an aircraft landing in Tehran, I mean, that's an export. There's no question about that. The question is, are there aspects of the aircraft or the systems on it that fall under, well, it could be under either, actually, but most likely the EAR. And yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, of course, too, they had to... whichever company does their flight planning it started out in Ghana, I guess, and whatever company did the flight planning certainly would have had to apply for visas to Tehran to land, or that would have been even uglier. So there are, through the paperwork channels, an awful lot of people that knew that this was an N-registered airplane, and over in that part of the world, at least, nobody seemed to be really worried about it.
The other aspect of this, I think we've talked about this in the past in a different context, is flight plans filed or not for business jets. Right now there's no requirement to do that. Isn't that right, Rob?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand. What do you mean flight plans? They had to have a flight plan in order to get into Tehran. They had to be on an IFR flight plan. And they had to have visas and all that other stuff in advance before they, before the Iranians would have even let them in their airspace. So there was prep. This airplane didn't just pop up.
Sure, sure. But isn't there some issue with private flights not having the same requirements to record passengers and purpose and destinations and that kind of thing? I thought that came up in the past with corporations not wanting to tip their hand as to, when they were going to a particular location to develop business, not tipping their hand to their competition. And that.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, there are ways in certainly in Western Europe and in North America and parts of South America where you can block the registration number. And they will just know that it is a, if you're on FlightAware, it is a Challenger, 604 or whatever it is, traveling from here to there, but you wouldn't know what the tail number was. I don't know if that is available in that part of the world, because it's not available everywhere. But that is one of the tricks that they like, is that business aviation doesn't want anybody to know who they are and when they go somewhere. And so that's another issue that this is just a chartered airplane. You don't know who's on it.
Right. All right. Well, speaking of someone going somewhere interesting, we have an article. This is from the Chicago Tribune. F-35 fighter jet to make first transatlantic flight in July. The F-35 is slated to show up at the Royal International Air Tattoo in July 11th through 13th, outside of London. And this is going to be pretty exciting. I think partly, Rob, that there's some promotional value in this. We know that there are countries that are kind of rethinking their procurement of the F-35. And so having it show up in an international forum like this is maybe it has, besides entertaining the crowd, might have some sort of business purposes as well.
Well, they are a little pricey. There's no doubt about that. So I think some of the orders may be reduced just a little bit so that at the Royal Air Tattoo, when someone comes up and says, I'd like to order F-35s, I'll take three. I'd like one in blue, one in red. Certainly it is hard for anybody to order airplanes of any kind if they've never seen them. And, unless these people are coming over to the States to see this airplane, which I've never even seen one up close. So of course I don't really think that actually means anything, but maybe I just don't get out enough.
Well, at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum at the Udvar-Hazy Center, there's a mock-up there. I think it's pretty much a mock-up of the F-35, including the Stovall apparatus that's in the F-35B model, which I think is the model that's planning on going to Riyadh in July. John, in terms of international membership, in the International Council of Air Shows, the Air Tattoo is one of them. Do you have a significant international membership as well as domestic here in the U.S.?
Yes, we have. I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I would say we probably have about 40 members outside of the United States and Canada, and that includes the Royal International Air Tattoo.
That's one of my that's on my bucket list of air shows that I've never been to that I would just love to attend. It's a pretty spectacular show.
It is. I was actually there 2 years ago, and they are probably, if not almost definitely, the premier air show in all of Europe. And they sort of have set the standard on some of their production, air operations, that sort of thing. And they regularly draw whatever the hottest plane is, in this case, like the F-35.
Now, when an F-35 or some aircraft like that is at an international show like that, do you provide any assistance to the show to set that up or to facilitate that, or do they just do that all on their own?
They do that all on their own. Royal International Air Tattoo is very adept at working the military senior leadership, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. To give them the opportunity to demonstrate the capabilities of these aircraft. And that's part of why they have such a, a wonderful reputation, not just in the UK, but all over the world.
Hmm. Okay.
What kind of tattoos do you put on an F-35?
I knew you were going to do that.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, you get a girl on a Harley or something?
No.
Oh.
David,
principally national insignia and small numbers. But
oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
But I understand it's still a painful process for the plane.
Okay.
David explained the whole tattoo part of this to us at one point, I recall. I don't know if you remember that. But when he comes back next time, if you've forgotten, he can explain it again.
Well, yeah, because they actually use the tattoo as another, in a more generic sense, with the British military and parades and
yeah, it's like a mustering kind of the troops or something, right?
Yeah. I was just making that up about the tattoos
okay.
on the airplane.
No body ink required.
No.
All right, we have an item from the Dallas News, their aviation blog. Spirit Airlines CEO Ben Baldanza responds to story about airline complaints. And you may recall last episode we talked about Spirit Airlines earning the distinction of being identified in a recent study as having the worst passenger complaint rate among U.S. airlines. That was in episode 295. So if you're interested in our comments on that, you can see airplanegeeks.com/295. Well, the CEO of Spirit came back and responded and is saying that we're dealing with very small complaint rates for all airlines. He says in his letter, quote, the industry averages around one or two complaints from every 100,000 customers, which is a great level of performance. He says our complaint rate is higher. Over the last 5 years, we've averaged 8 complaints per 100,000 customers. He says that means 99,992 customers did not file a complaint, while 8 did. That is a very, very small number, he says, but not one with which we are satisfied. For the last few months, complaints about Spirit have declined by over 30% to 5 per 100,000 customers, and still we're not satisfied.
You gotta love this, though, with it. He uses the percentage. This guy's name is really Ben Michael O'Leary Baldanza. I mean, really, because this guy could have said, well, one or two complaints per 100,000 is the norm, and we're at 8, which is about 400% more, which would have sounded really bad.
Right.
But he does manage to figure out a way to talk about a 30% reduction, which sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, he spun it pretty well.
You got to love him. He turned a lemon into lemonade.
Yeah, very good.
And then they had the sale. Did you see that part?
The sale?
They had a sale for being 99-point-something%, keeping that percentage of the passengers happy. Anyway, like I said, no Spirit for me. Thanks.
John, do you have a way to measure sort of satisfaction, customer satisfaction, air show goer satisfaction? Is there any kind of metrics or anything that you guys do?
Yeah, for nearly 3 decades now, we've done a biennial survey of spectators. It's typically about 2,000 spectators at 10 different shows around the country selected to give us an accurate cross-section of the entire industry. And we, one of the questions we ask is overall satisfaction, the types of aircraft and acts that they prefer to see, and areas that could be improved. And in any one year, that's interesting information, but it's particularly interesting when you look at it over the course of many years to see where the interest waxes and wanes and where problems are addressed or not addressed, or in some cases, new problems pop up. And I spend quite a lot of time with that data to help to aid in different types of programming that we do. So it's for me, I'm kind of immersed in it over the last 15 or so years. And you see some very interesting trends.
How many of the big air shows do you go to every year, John?
In a typical, this year's a little atypical so far. But in a typical year, I try to get to about one a month, which ends up being 6 or 7 each year.
You might have the best job in the business.
I certainly have enjoyed my time with the International Council of Air Shows.
Wow. Okay.
Do you get up to AirVenture?
I do. Most years I get to AirVenture, yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay.
All right. One last quick news item. This is fairly recent. We saw in the news was it a teenager, Rob, that stowed away on this airplane?
I think it was a 16-year-old that stowed away supposedly on a... Gee, what airline was this? You know, I don't think I even noticed. I just know it was a Boeing 767 on a trip between San Francisco and Honolulu. And he stowed away in the wheel well of the 767, let's just say allegedly. And that after 5 hours plus in the wheel well of the 767 at, I don't know, probably 36, 37,000 feet with minus 40 to minus 50 degree temperatures. And as John mentioned before we started the show, no oxygen.
Yeah. If the cold's not bad enough.
He arrived in good health in Honolulu and dressed in nothing spectacular. I mean, in terms of, you know, no heavy coat, no gloves, no boots, none of that. I think this story has an air of, well, maybe somewhat hot air-ish
about
it.
You're skeptical.
I'm skeptical, yes. I'm sorry. I'm skeptical. I think this is baloney, but that's just me.
Well, if it's real, the kid is, I don't know. The kid is lucky, but I don't know why.
So if he's... Is he lucky or are we stupid? I don't know. I don't know.
Quite. Well, he's not too bright for trying it, but...
Right.
And the success rate of this is apparently fairly low. Just before we started recording, my wife was doing a little bit of research on this, and she found, and I don't know the source, but she found that there have been 105 people who've been recorded as trying this kind of stunt since 1947. And the survival rate is 24%, which, you know, that sounds kind of high to me, Rob, considering the, you know, the environment that you're in.
Well, but you know what we don't know in those figures is that we don't know how old the survival rate might be. I mean, back in the days when people were stowing away, perhaps in airplanes that didn't go, you know, didn't travel quite as high. Maybe the survival rate was better, but I don't know. I can't. Every time I hear about somebody finding a dead body in their backyard and they realize later that it fell out of an airplane when they put the gear down 3 or 4 miles, you know, straight out from the end of the runway, you go, oh, you know, that kind of makes sense. But I haven't heard about a whole lot of people surviving this. And again, I'm. You know, maybe there's a physician out there amongst our listeners that can tell me what the survival rate is. I mean, you know, all right. I'm sorry. I just thought of something because when we have a cabin decompression at altitude, you know, even in some of the jets that I flew at 30, 35,000 feet with no oxygen, they figure our time of useful consciousness is maybe less than 60 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, because there's not enough air. But this kid made it at that altitude with no air for 5.5 hours. I'm having a little trouble with this.
Interesting. Well, this is definitely in the don't try this at home category for sure. All right, let's move on to our main topic now. We're speaking with John Cudahy. He is the president of the International Council of Air Shows. John, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks, Max. Good to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about the membership of the council. Who belongs to the council?
It's people who put on air shows, individuals and organizations, people who perform at air shows, so principally our pilots, and what we call support service providers. And that can range from air bosses and announcers to concessionaires, insurance company photographers, and the like.
Well, when you consider, you know, all of those different people, all of those different roles involved in putting together an air show, that's a lot of people.
It is, yeah. Each year at our convention, we have about 1,500 people who come for the purpose of learning how to organize and conduct air shows better, more profitably, and safer. And and also to plan for the upcoming air show season. So 1,500 people represents quite a lot of people all by itself, and there's probably 6, 7, 8 times that many who are involved but don't make it to our convention.
This year's convention, is that, do I remember correctly, is that in November?
No, sir. It's in early December in Las Vegas.
December in Las Vegas. And is there going to be a theme established, or is it kind of a little bit too early for that?
Yeah, it's a little too early. The focus of the industry right now is in trying to plan for any possible repeat of the 2013 situation in which we lost the involvement of the military. So our industry suffered quite a lot last year when because of sequestration, the military didn't participate. And our goal now is to welcome the military back, as we are in the industry this year, but also make contingency plans that if this happens again, it won't be quite so hard on the entire business.
That sounds very smart. And what is the situation this year? Are we back to the situation with military performers that we had in 2012, or is it something in between?
Something in between. Both of the military jet teams, the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels, both of the military jump teams, the U.S. Navy Leapfrogs and the U.S. Army Golden Knights, the Marine Corps aircraft, the V-22 Osprey and the AV-8B Harrier, and the Air Force's F-22 Raptor are all participating at levels similar to 2011 and before. We've lost our single ship Navy demos, F-18s, and we've lost F-16s and A-10s as well. Our industry is struggling to get them back because those single ship demos are a very important part of our business. But we are very, very happy to welcome back those military performers that will be performing a full schedule this year.
Now, our co-host David Vanderhoof, who's not here this episode, has said in the past that there are a couple of benefits to having these military acts and the performers in the air shows. One is because of the draw that it provides to the air show, and the another being the sort of the recruiting effect, the way that these performances cause people to become interested in careers in military aviation. Is that kind of a fair assessment, do you think?
I think it's only a partial assessment. All of what you said is true, but I think there are many other benefits. In an era when our military is all volunteer and a smaller and smaller percentage of citizens are members of the armed forces, air shows are often the only time that the general public has an opportunity to interface with the people who serve in uniform. And that came into sharp definition last year when virtually all military participation in air shows dried up. And I think part of why the military is performing once again this year and appearing at air shows in a number of different capacities is that they discovered that air shows are a more important part of their public outreach than they had first realized. All that dried up last year, and to a very significant extent, the American military lost its capacity to engage in conversation with the American public. And we don't have anything that definitively says this, but all indications I've had in my conversations with military leadership is that they missed that more than they had anticipated they would.
Well, John, I have a quick question. I mean, if you had to look at percentages, what percent of a, I don't know if there is such a thing as an average show, but what percentage does the military typically represent of the content of a show?
As you might expect, it's a simple question with a very complicated answer.
Yeah, I'm good at that.
The two jet teams each perform at approximately 35 shows per year. So together, they appear at 70 shows. In a typical year, there are about 350 air shows. So when you talk just about the two military jet teams, that means that something like 250 to 280 shows do not have one of the two American military jet teams. Of the remaining shows, some of them get one of the two parachute jump teams. Some of them get Marine Corps, Navy, or Air Force single ship demo aircraft. But a big thing that's missing this year as well is the static display aircraft. One of the more popular things at a typical air show is a C-130, a C-17, a C-5, or even some fighter aircraft on static display. In addition to the aerial entertainment, they give spectators an opportunity to see what a military airplane looks like. And the ones that are large enough, they actually get to walk through. And the others, there's typically a crew member on hand to explain the plane, its mission, its capacity to wage war, how fast it goes, and so forth. And that's a big element of air shows. And all that together, it's just a guess, but I would think that the military participates in about 80% of the air shows that are conducted in the United States in a typical year. This is not typical because we've lost not just those single ship demos that I mentioned earlier, but also virtually all of the static display aircraft.
That's interesting. So we're certainly not going to be back to where we were pre-sequestration.
Not this year. We're hopeful. We're continuing to work with the military and explain some of these facts about the business and about their participation in the business. And we've gotten largely a positive reception, and it's, I think it's going to be an ongoing effort. You can't wipe away the fact that military funding is down a good deal from what it was just a couple of years ago. That that money needs to be found somewhere. But it's our hope that as we become more familiar with the environment in which we're working, the military will understand that they can do things like static display aircraft at no significant additional cost, or that their outreach that they get with the single ship demos is important enough that they spend that marginal additional money to be more thoroughly represented beyond the two jet teams.
Now, some people may be wondering, you know, how do you find out about where air shows are in their area? And the International Council of Air Shows website, which we should mention is www.airshows.aero, A-E-R-O, you have a very useful air shows calendar on that site.
I'm glad you took the time to look that up. We have the shows listed in a number of ways. We have a big map of North America and sort of a interactive kind of thing. You can also sort by date or by state and some other sorts as well. And it is a useful tool. If there's people among your listeners that are looking for an air show, either on a particular date or with a particular performer, or in a particular area of the country, it functions pretty well.
Yeah, I really like this map view. It's probably based on a Google Maps sort of a thing, but what it does is it shows the locations of all the air shows, and you can zoom in or zoom out and shift around on the map depending on what area you live in or are going to be visiting. And then you can see the air shows marked on there, and then if you click on the air show, the icon for that air show, it gives you more information about it. I think that's this is very handy. This is a very good way to discover shows because, you know, I think people are probably familiar with, you know, many of the sort of major air shows in the United States or in whatever country, you know, you live in. But there really are a lot of other air shows, aren't there, besides those big-name major air shows?
There are, and some of them are my favorites. Not to pick on any one particular show, but in the first week of June in Reading, Pennsylvania, there's a show called World War II Weekend, and that's among the most interesting shows in the business as far as I'm concerned. They have sort of a standing rule that no aircraft built or flown only after 1945 is allowed to be there. And so when you walk in, you've got reenactors and Abbott and Costello impersonators, Andrews Sisters impersonators. There's a French village with German occupying forces and a wide variety of vehicles as well, in addition to some of the most well-restored and in some cases exotic warbirds anywhere in the country. And it is a comparatively small show. I would guess probably between 25 and 30,000 people there over the course of the weekend. But it is both very unique, I think, and different from what you were describing earlier as kind of a typical air show. And some of the other shows focus on vintage aircraft or naval aviation. There are some other warbird specialty shows. And to me, one of the more interesting things about the business is how different some of these air shows can be from one another.
Hmm. John, which air show did you say that was in Pennsylvania?
It's called the World War II Weekend in Reading, Pennsylvania.
And oh, here
Reading,
it is. Yeah, so I'm looking at the map we were just talking about, and I see Reading. It's got a little airplane over it. I click on that. It tells me that it's July 26th and 27th in Reading, Pennsylvania. Link to the air show, link to the information about the performers. This is brilliant. This is really nicely done.
Well, there's actually two. That is the second show at the Reading Airport, but there I don't have a calendar in front of me, but there should be one like June 4th, 5th, 6th in that area, and that's also held at the same airport, and that's the World War II specialty air show.
Oh, okay. We'll have to look into that, definitely. That's not too far from me and very close to where David lives in Philadelphia. Well, maybe we can arrange to be there for that one. When you talk about air shows, you know, an item that comes up frequently is air show safety. And there, you know, we see occasionally some accidents at air shows, which of course is really unfortunate. And I imagine that the council takes that kind of stuff pretty seriously.
Yeah, we do. And if there's a single air show accident in any given year, that's, as far as we're concerned, that's one too many. We commit quite a lot of the resources of the association, our members, our staff, to doing everything we can to improve our safety record. Having said that, the steps we've taken just during the last 20 years has reduced the accident rate in our business more than 70%. And when it comes to spectator safety, there's not been a fatality at a North American air show since 1951. That's more than 60 years now. And it is a safety record that exceeds almost any other motorsport. Without pointing fingers at our friends in the other motorsports, it is not unusual to hear about fatal accidents in almost every kind of motorsport. But there has not, as I said, there's not been a fatality at a North American air show in more than 60 years among spectators.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Because we've seen some accidents with performers, of course. Are there other trends or things going on in the air show space that is taking up the sort of the thoughts of the council?
Yeah, I kind of alluded to it earlier. 2013 was a very difficult year for the business because of sequestration. We discovered just how dependent we've become over the last three decades on military participation. So, coming out of 2013, a lot of energy has been focused on how do we recover from that? How do we avoid it? Perhaps the best example of the kind of thinking that will allow us to do that is an introduction of a new aircraft by a pilot by the name of John Klatt. John Klatt has a corporate sponsorship with Jack Link's Beef Jerky, and he has built a custom airplane, a Waco biplane, with a radial engine and a jet strapped underneath the Waco biplane.
Wow.
And to say the least, it has some unusual flight characteristics. It can accelerate going uphill. It has a much greater thrust and weight. It's going to be a very special aircraft. It will debut in the third week of May at a military show in Rhode Island, and John and his team will then campaign that all year long. What I think the industry is coming to understand is that the military is an important part of our business, but we should have a lineup of civilian acts that can sustain an air show in the absence of the military, so that in a bad year when military can't participate, we still have an excellent entertainment product. And it just gets that much better when we do have the military. I think that is the model that the industry will be moving toward. And I think the beneficiaries really will be everybody. The spectators will get a better product. The air shows will get some stability and confidence that they can sustain the loss of the military. And the civilian performers will become both more integral and more well-recognized by the spectating public.
And that makes that seems to make an awful lot of sense to me. Sometimes we learn lessons the hard way. Sometimes the unexpected happens, and the best thing to do is, or one of the best things to do is to put some thought into how do you at least minimize the impact if that happens again. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Rob, you got anything else for John that you wanted to ask?
Well, I guess we might as well just have saved this until the end. I've been waiting all evening for this. So, John, if we show up at an air show and we can't get in, can we give them your name and get in?
Well, it would. It depends on the air show. There's some that will send you packing if you mention my name. But
could you maybe offline send us a list of those so we make sure we don't go there?
But certainly, if we correspond early, we can help you get into some of the shows and maybe give you a peek behind the curtain as well.
Fantastic! That'd be great.
Cool,
that'd be something
yeah.
that we could share with our listeners. All right. Again, the website is www.airshows.com. Aero, A-E-R-O. Is that the best way, John, for folks to learn more?
It is. It is principally an inside the industry website, but as you pointed out, our calendar is pretty user-friendly, very interactive, and it is undoubtedly the most thorough listing of air shows in the United States and Canada that exists.
Perfect. And our listeners, I think, will find that very, very valuable. So you guys go out there and take a look at that. Find an air show or two or three that you can attend and, you know, support the activity. Plus, you have such a great time. There's nothing like an air show.
Amen.
All right, John, thank you so much for spending a little time with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in this week's NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, guys. Here are four words you can add to your in-flight vocabulary. Climb via and descend via. What do they mean and when will you hear them? Well, that topic is coming up Monday on NBAA's Flight Plan. You'll find us in the news update section at nbaa.org.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 19th of April, 2014.
Well, g'day folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 296. And coming to you this morning from a Cirrus SR20, and I'm here with ATC Ben, and talking about the Australia Desk, we're flying 9,000 feet above Australia as we speak.
That's right, mate. We are just under 100 miles to our destination. We're going to the NatFly air show at Tamora, the code for that Yankee Tango Echo Mike. We're up at 9,000 feet. It's a beautiful blue sky day. It's cold and overcast and looking like rain in Melbourne. But up here, it's a beautiful day, and we're going to go and have some fun.
Yeah, we had some fun this morning. We departed from Essendon Airport, which we've talked about many times on the Ausdesk, and straight up into some IMC. So some good instrument flying for you, Ben.
Yeah, that's right. That instrument rating does come in handy when you live in Melbourne, so you can punch out of the cloud. And we broke out on top at about 7,000, and now the cloud's finished at the Great Dividing Range, and we're in blue sky, and be a nice visual descent approach.
I've got to tell you, mate, I know I said this the last time that we went up flying in this particular aircraft, and I know Rob will love this. You know, as a Cessna driver, I'm in love with this Cirrus, I tell you. It's just a wonderful aircraft.
That's right. I wish I was paying what Rob was paying for his Cirrus, but unfortunately aviation is a little more expensive in this country. But yeah, at the moment, it makes it flying IMC a lot easier. At the moment, George is flying, and it relegates you into a pilot monitoring role, which makes single pilot IFO a lot easier and a lot safer.
Now, we talked many times before about, as user fees here in Australia, and of course the Linfox Corporation is the current leaseholder at Essendon, where we departed from this morning, but they also own the lease, a particularly long lease, at Avalon Airport.
Tense profile speed, if effect is required, just let me know, thanks.
Oh, annoying air traffic control there. And I noticed the news this week, Ben, they've actually noticed that they've announced at Avalon that they're going to make themselves, quote-unquote, more GA-friendly and reduce, not abolish, but reduce those ridiculously high user fees.
1-2-3.75. Let them know if you need
effective. Well, the problem is, as much as the CEO would say that, but the guy who owns the airport still wants to make far too much money out of it and not use it as an airport. So, you know that the statement was a bit of a media thing when it was spruced that the landing fees were as low as $30.
So there you go, folks. If you want to fly a bug smasher now into Avalon Airport, it's still going to cost you $30. And if you want to run down the ILS, it's still going to cost you a fortune. Not as much as a fortune as it used to, but it's a real bugbear of mine. Having done my license in the US, it just annoys me no end.
Yeah, that's right, and you'll notice the bit with the as well as, if you went and did the research, the as well as only applies to certain periods of the day that they've defined for GA training when the airline aircraft aren't operating in and out of Avalon. If you want to go when the airline is going, it still costs you, I think it was a low $100.
A low $100 Australian dollars. That's about $90 US at the moment. Anyway, speaking of airports with user fees, the one we're going to doesn't have any as far as I know. That's Tamora, a wonderful aviation museum up there. Grant's at Leeton, which is, 50 or 60 nautical miles to the southwest of there. Here's our flying balloons, and I guess you'll say a quick hello there. Take it away, Grant.
Hey, everyone. It's a wonderful morning. We're 1,500 feet above the ground here at Leeton in New South Wales, in the air with probably about 15 other balloons, I'd say. There's a couple more back there that haven't got off the ground yet. They're the really slow ones. And I'm too busy to do an Ausdesk. I'm having fun flying. So this is my little segment for the Ausdesk. And really quickly, I'm up here with two complete newbies. I'm taking a couple of passengers up who've never flown. Say hi.
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 And that was Sean and that was Jason. They're both a bit terrified. They're hanging on for dear life and they're just a little bit too stressed to really talk because, hey, they know who their pilot is. So, guys, how's the view?
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely
you
brilliant.
See everything as far as anything.
It's great, isn't it? Hey, I'm burnt.
It's like the most clear day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful up here.
I've lived here for 11 and a half years and this is a different view than I've seen before.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I'm going to leave it back to ATC Ben and Steve to finish off the Ausdesk because I've got to start looking at descending. We're trying to chase another balloon and see if we can get close to where he is, but I'm not too worried. We're having fun and I'm clocking time. So I'm going to put one last big burn in so you can hear the real burner. And then I'm going to shut this down and give it back to the guys. Have fun.
Well, there you go, Ben. It sounds like Grant's having way too much fun. I'm glad he's putting his balloons over there sufficiently away from where we are. Because, you know, I've seen Grant drive. I hate to think the way he flies a balloon. But anyway.
Well, that's right, mate. If he was with us, not only would he be only be going 32 knots, he'd be going in the wrong direction. So, thankfully, we've got the Continental up the front, and it's taking us in the correct direction. And Adelaide's 166 knots, if you don't mind.
There we go. Okay, well, I think we'll call it time for this Australia Desk this week. Just a quick one. Not much news on the Australian aviation front this week. Of course, the search for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 drags on. They still haven't found it as we record this. They keep telling us they're getting closer, Ben, but I don't know. It's just a complete mystery to all of us.
Yeah, it seems to be one step forward and three steps backwards at the moment. We've got to find something at some point because that's a very large airplane just go missing.
Yes, it certainly is, but I'm sure as time goes on, mystery will unravel and it'll give us lots to talk about at the time. But until then, we're going to have a bit of lunch while we're here in flight. The autopilot's doing a fantastic job and we're going to enjoy a great time at NatFly and we'll have some interviews in the next episode of Flying Crazy Down Under. Number 118, and hopefully we'll have that out within the next week or so, hopefully, if I stop being so lazy. Quite easy to be lazy up here at 9,000 feet, though. So until then, I'm Steve Fisher, enjoying this flight.
And I'm ATC Ben, steering the ship.
Cheers, folks.
That sounds like fun.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah. Boate, I am jealous. Steve and Ben, because the Cirrus I was supposed to fly this week broke.
No.
Now I have to come up with something else.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you'd been up in the Cirrus lately.
Yeah, and and you get spoiled. In fact, some interesting figures that Cirrus sold more single-engine airplanes in this country last year than any other manufacturer. They beat Beech, Cessna and Piper, and of course Mooney is now back in production for, I don't know, the seventh time or something. But there's going to be some ugly news this week. Maybe out by the time this hits on Wednesday, but Beechcraft is going to have some massive layoffs due to the absorption by Textron. And everybody kind of knew this was probably coming, but the actual facts should hit sometime this week.
Well, I guess you sort of have to expect that kind of a thing.
That's right. See, and someday if you ever get a real job, you're going to have to worry about that.
I had a real job. I'm done with a real job.
That's right. Hey, listen, you paid your dues for a couple of years. You deserve retirement.
Yeah, 35. But I'm not dead, so there's still lots to do. You know, one thing I liked about that report, or one thing that I thought was kind of a interesting contrast, was going from the Cirrus to the balloon with Grant. And of course, you expect the noise level to be quite a bit different, don't you?
Yeah, except for that part where Grant cut out, when he said something really ugly and he made that sound effect, that roaring sound, yeah. And that blocked out the ugly language. That was pretty cool, Grant.
Yeah, very good. Nice job, guys. And now it's time for Rob's Aviation Minute. Rob, what are we looking at this week?
Well, Max, this week I'm talking about the TSA. And I ran into them again on a trip to San Diego last week for a Flight Safety Foundation safety conference. And as much as it kills me to say this, I think I'm going to say something nice about them again. But rather than give away the plot, let's just cue it up and see what people think. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. I can't believe I'm going to say something nice about the TSA folks again. That makes twice in 2 months. Yikes! Now, I still fly quite a bit, although these days I travel long distances in the cabin of an airliner, not up front. As a corporate pilot, though, I've always told my friends that there is no worse place on earth to put a bizjet pilot than near the end of the cabin on an airliner. It's always noisier, of course, but row 23 doesn't give me much of a chance to run to the cockpit and help should the crew need me. In case of an emergency. Okay, Walter Mitty dreams aside, the worst part of airline flying is the time it wastes because it has so many different customers to cope with. I have to arrive 2 hours early so there's time to pay the airline to carry my luggage, of course. Then I try not to look sad and already exhausted when I turn the corner and see hundreds of people snaked around in the line to go through the TSA security check. Now, though, for $100, I can move to the front of the line, or at least closer to it, by using the TSA's new pre-check card. It's tied into the agency's Trusted Traveler program. That offers me easier access returning the states from abroad. The pre-check program gets me through security faster when I'm leaving a major U.S. hub. The benefit's more than just being near the front of the line, though. It means I no longer need to take off my belt and my shoes, and I don't even need to pull my laptop out of the bag. And no more of those goofy X-ray scanners. You know, the ones that make you raise your arm skyward like you're being held up. This saves me at least 20 to 25 minutes every time I fly, if not more. The card's good for 5 years, so it makes my annual cost about $20. I think it's worth it. All of this said, though, there is a bit of a glitch in the system that bears mentioning. TSA recently said it might need to cut back on pre-check services if they don't get more people to sign up. So they've started randomly offering the service for free to some airline passengers. The problem is, these test passengers don't seem to know what they're doing in line. The screeners just kind of shove them in ahead of the rest of us, and honestly, they're clogging up the works because they still try to take off their clothes and pull their laptops out and all the rest. So here's a friendly note to the TSA. You know I love you guys, but please, if you're going to let someone see what pre-check might be like if they sign up, try a little marketing 101. Give these folks a printed card that explains how we play the game in the pre-check line. And then for goodness sake, tell them how to sign up so the rest of us get to keep using pre-check. It's really worth it. For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark in Chicago.
All right, we have a brief listener story. This one came in from Bill Ashton, and he sent us an MP3 file or something equivalent. And let's turn it over to Bill and listen to him.
My undergraduate pilot training began in 1972 with the screening phase. We student pilots flew with civilian CFIs in Cessna 172s through about 14 hours of flying time and a couple of solo flights. The idea was to screen out those candidates who would likely not be successful before the Air Force spent a great deal of time and money on them in the rest of training. Just to keep us in our place, we were allowed to wear flight suits but couldn't wear boots until we started flying a real jet, the Cessna C-37, that is if we made it past the screening phase. So branded as newbies in our low-quarter shoes, we flew out of Lubbock Municipal Airport instead of nearby Reese Air Force Base. I was a newly minted second lieutenant and was flailing about the skies of Lubbock, Texas with the best of them. The land was featureless except for the world's best navigation aids, the northeast-southwest section roads that seemed to mark the earth forever, every mile or so. The wind was constant, and my civilian instructor, Larry Jeter, was among the best. The day of my first solo dawned clear, and the winds out of the west grew to 15 to 20 knots as the day wore on. This wasn't at all unusual for Lubbock, but gave us some good crosswind practice on our north-south runway, which was actually just painted on the edge of the ramp where the aircraft were parked downwind. But Larry had confidence in me, and as he left the airplane, wished me the best. Unfortunately, my first solo landing was both relatively hot and with a good bit of sound downwind drift. I survived it, and the next two, although I'm sure that none of them were very pretty. As I parked and sheepishly departed the airport, Larry advised me to clean off the seat in the airplane and then clean off the seat in the truck in which he was observing my solo and report to him in the briefing room. My life flashed before my eyes as I considered a missile silo assignment in North Dakota that was rumored to be the punishment for those who washed out of pilot training. However, Larry surprised me by telling me that although my solo had definitely been shaky, he was confident I'd make a good pilot and was not going to wash me out. Well, fast forward 4 to 5 years. After leaving Larry and the screening phase behind, I did well enough in pilot training to select a T-38 instructor pilot job. And after instructor pilot training down at Randolph Air Force Base, reported back to Reese as a T-38 instructor pilot. I also completed my civilian training as an instrument instructor, and took on some civilian students when I had time. We had a small but nagging problem at Reese, and it was the shallow water airport. It was a small, privately owned airport about 5 miles north of our center runway, right under the T-38 straight-in final approach. In spite of numerous posters and warnings in the area, civilian pilots still periodically strayed into our pattern. This was obviously even more a dangerous practice for them than for us, because at least we had ejection seats. So one day, as I'm preparing a briefing, the deputy commander for operations, the number two colonel on base, called me. He asked if, with my civilian flight instructor experience, I could come with him to the shallow water airport to read the owner the riot act. Well, being a captain, my choices were limited, but he was nice enough to ask. And as we approached the operations building at the shallow water airport, well, actually, it was the only building at the shallow water airport, we were approached by a not too pleasant harbinger of things to come. One of our steely-eyed Air Force trained killers, an instructor pilot from another squadron at Reese, had just returned from a joyride and had planted one of shallow water's finest Cherokees up above the wheel fairings in one of West Texas's finest mud puddles. You know, Air Force pilots have very little experience with turf runways after a rainy night. But you can see the biggest surprise that was yet to come. When we were introduced to the airport manager, it was, yes, Larry Jeter. Now, it was impossible for me to read the riot act to Mr. Jeter, the CFI who was responsible as any for my coveted Air Force pilot wings. And thankfully, the number two colonel on base was a real gentleman. All of our concerns were expressed and addressed amicably. And as far as I know, there were no more near misses over shallow water Texas. But a very important lesson was learned. In aviation, as in the rest of life, we live in very small communities. It never pays to burn bridges and always pays to build respect. So here's to Larry and all the other fine CFIs like him. We all owe them a great debt of gratitude.
Wow. Thanks for that, Bill. What a great story, Rob.
Yeah, that really was. I wondered where he was going with that. Well, of course, we had a chance to hear it before the show. Boy, isn't it amazing when you, in this business, the number of times that I've thought, oh my gosh, look who's here. And it's somebody I haven't seen in 10 or 15 years or who knows what, because aviation, like a lot of industries, is really a small world at its core.
Absolutely. And I find that happens, you know, at a variety of different levels. I mean, even when I was involved in the, you know, commercial aviation side, you know, you would meet someone, you would develop a relationship, maybe, you know, conduct some business or whatever. And then, you know, you each move on to something else. But, you know, a year or two later, 3 years, sometimes 10 years later, you come back and you get, you know, reassociated with that person. And so if you're in this business, I mean, yeah, like Bill says, you don't want to burn any bridges. But you also, you know, my advice is you also want to develop that network. Because it can really benefit you and others down the road. You know, keep those relationships strong, and sooner or later, you know, there'll be some mutual way that you can do something for each other.
Well, you know, and I want to just second that, because as my daughter's, you know, getting on in her college experience, I have tried to bring her up by saying that when you are at an event, and you meet somebody that you think is interesting, get a card from them and just say you'd like to stay in touch at some point, because that is something that I have. I wish I could say I did it consciously, but it's just something I always did for all the years I've been in the business. And the number of times that I have had an opportunity or something come along that I say, boy, I wish I knew. Oh, wait a minute. I remember that guy I met at so-and-so place, and right. I've still got his card, and I'll call him up and give him an idea, or I will ask for advice, and everybody is just always happy to help, because everybody likes to be made to feel like they're special, and you know, they have some good advice to share, and you just have to ask them, and most people don't. They do not ask for help.
Yeah, and it's there. You just have to take advantage of it. All right, well said, Rob. The Airplane Geeks invite you to join us for the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's Become a Pilot Family Day and Aviation Display. This June 14, 2014 event will be held at the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, located in Chantilly, Virginia, adjacent to Dulles International Airport. Besides viewing the museum's amazing indoor aircraft displays, you'll have an opportunity to walk around the 50 or so visiting vintage, recreational, and home-built aircraft at an outdoor display and meet the pilots. The event features presentations, tours, and hands-on activities for all ages. And as in past years, we'll set up our mobile studio inside the museum and record interviews and content for the podcast, so be sure to come by and say hello. We're also planning a social event that evening at a local restaurant, and we hope you'll be able to join us for some food, drink, and great AvGeek conversation. So that's Saturday, June 14, 2014, at the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center. Bring your friends and family for a really unique experience at the National Air and Space Museum's Become a Pilot Day. For more information, visit airplanegeeks.com/become-a-pilot. And we'll see you there. In Feedback from listeners. We received some email. We got an interesting one from Mike. This is a link to a news item. Crew of British Airways flight from DFW last fall needed 5 extinguishers to put out flames. So 2 hours before landing at Heathrow, this British Airways flight, it was coming from Dallas-Fort Worth, they had a fire in the in-flight entertainment system. And the Air Accidents Investigation Branch of the Department of Transportation report says the crew had to use 5 fire extinguishers because the fire kept reigniting. And the reason the fire kept reigniting was that...
Lithium ion batteries!
No, it wasn't that.
Oh.
No, they didn't shut the power off to the IFE. Now, Mike is kind of raising this in an interesting context with MH370, where we see that, some of the transponders and the equipment was either shut off or otherwise rendered inoperable. You know, the question is, who can shut off which systems? In this case, it was just, you know, something as simple as the in-flight entertainment system, but it posed a serious, you know, serious problem. Fire on an airplane is not a good thing. But, you know, sort of the general issue is what authority or what ability should the flight crew, the cabin crew, whoever have to affect these systems?
Well, I think the guidelines up until recently have been that for something like in-flight entertainment, there certainly are breakers somewhere that someone can get to. Now, whether they were already cooked and they weren't working, or someone wasn't operating it properly, I don't know. But in the newer airplanes, I mean, 787 type, there are not a whole lot of circuit breakers that can be pulled. In fact, a lot of them are electronic. And essentially, and we see this in a lot of corporate airplanes too, they are designed in such a way that if the manufacturer thinks that there's nothing the crew can do anyway, whether they pull a breaker or not, they don't even bother to put one in. And so that's, you know, that does, at least to the pilots, make them feel like they have less flexibility. But in essence, they probably don't if there's, you know, it's not really going to do anything anyhow.
All right, let's move on. We heard from Charlie in Annapolis. Have you ever been to Annapolis, Rob?
No, I never have. I know that's the home of the U.S. Naval Academy, but I've never been there.
Yeah, Annapolis is fantastic. I love Annapolis. Beautiful town. Lots to do, lots to see. Lots of good food.
That's in Nevada, right?
Yeah, no, Maryland. Oh, I should probably
Maryland,
say that.
Right. Well, it's almost Nevada.
Yeah, Maryland. So I wish David was here for this, because Charlie is talking about, well, about the A-10 retirement. And we've talked about that a bit. David's talked about it. Charlie thinks David is wrong on this, but we've certainly seen a lot of passion from listeners in emails, sort of on both sides of the issue. Charlie talks about the costs of the F-35 and compared to the costs of maintaining the A-10s, and kind of notes that there's a big differential. That the A-10s for that mission, is, I think he's saying, would represent a much lower cost than the alternatives. So I want to thank Charlie for sending that along. Again, so apologize that David's not here to defend himself. And I'm sure David has a strong feeling, and we'll try to bring that in a future episode.
Well, didn't I see something this week that that Senator McCain from Arizona was going to try and support the continued operation of the Warthogs?
Yes, I did see that as well. You're right. He is trying to make a stand in that issue, probably because of the value of keeping the A-10 to his home district, I guess.
Oh, right.
But I'm just speculating, pure speculation on the motivation for the, you know, the political position. Let's see. Well, we mentioned MH370. Rob Coates sent us a recording thinking about his thoughts on how small a Boeing 777 really is and what should be done so that we never have to repeat this situation we had with, or we have as we speak, with MH370 and where it is. So here's Rob.
G'day geeks, Rob Coates in Perth, Western Australia here. Just listened to episode 295 and as always, it was a great show. Peter Johnson's comments on MH370 and how a plane as big as a 777 could possibly get lost set me musing on its size relative to the ocean it's lost in. Wikipedia tells us that the Indian Ocean has an area of about 73 million square kilometres. So if you park 777s wing to wing and nose to tail, you could fit about 17.5 billion, yes billion, aircraft on its floor. This makes finding a needle in a haystack a comparative doddle, or a cinch for you Yanks. Since Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge became the world's first person to die in a powered airplane crash in 1908, there have been many advances in aviation safety and many devices and procedures mandated so that today we have a phenomenally safe commercial aviation industry. Perhaps the next thing to be made compulsory should be the bursts of data that Rob talked about in episode 295. If MH370 had transmitted its location, speed, altitude and heading, it'd be 2 or 3 minutes before it went down, the search area would have been greatly reduced. Even if just its last transmitted location was known, in 3 minutes at cruising speed, it could only be inside a circle about 90 kilometres across. Who would pay for all this if it's made compulsory? In the end, the passengers, of course. But the industry and its customers have come to terms with paying for black boxes, licensing of pilots and aircraft engineers, compulsory periodic maintenance, navigation aids, seatbelts, oxygen masks, the list goes on. And we passengers are the beneficiaries. How many more hugely expensive and, for the relatives of the missing passengers and crew, shatteringly traumatic mid-ocean searches will need to take place before the provision of such transmissions are put back on the table and mandated? Keep up the good work, geeks, and it's Huru from Perth.
Well, nicely said, Rob. I think he's probably as smart as he is because of his name, of course. But he makes some very, very good points. And I was having lunch when I was in San Diego this last week for the Flight Safety Foundation Business Aviation Seminar and Safety Seminar. And this fellow's a captain for a major airline. And we were talking about just this topic. And I said, just confirm for me that no airline that you know about anywhere is ever going to do anything safety-related until it is mandated. Doesn't matter how nice it might be or how valuable it might appear to be. I ask, I can't tell you how many people in the industry, and they all say the same thing. That now, maybe our listeners are of a different opinion, but I'd be curious if all of you around the world are thinking something different about the country you live in, because for us, pretty much, it ain't going to happen until the FAA puts in a regulation about it.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to believe that that wouldn't be necessary, but I think I do agree with you, Rob, that it is as a practical matter. And also because we're talking about, you know, something that needs to be done globally. It's very difficult for, you know, local interests to go down that path, in that having some kind of, you know, larger entity dictate those kind of requirements is what we're going to have to see. I don't know if we will or not. I really don't have a feel for if it'll come to pass or not.
You mean about sort of extra monitoring kinds of issues or?
Right, whether there's requirements established, regulations established, regulatory requirements that that change the situation so that we don't find ourselves in this kind of dilemma that we have with MH370.
Well, you know what's really kind of discouraging, though, is that we were talking about this within a couple of years after Air France 447 disappeared. There's some paperwork that I tracked down through ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization in Montreal, that said that there were proposals on the table in, I believe it was 2012, for additional monitoring, and those ideas just never went anywhere. And so now we're saying, this time we really got it. I'll bet you a year from now, and despite the fact that there's a conference next month that was called at the last minute in Montreal to look at aircraft monitoring situations, that just came out the other day. I'm not sure how many countries are going to be there, but I'll bet you any money a year from now we're still going to be talking about it.
We may still be looking for MH370 a year from now.
Well said. Well, it took 2 years to find Air France, and we had a pretty good idea of where it was. We haven't found one single shred of physical evidence, not a piece of metal, not a floating suitcase or a seat cushion or anything on this airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not looking real good.
All right, so let's finish up with an email from Rich. Rich sent along his favorite aviation museum, the Aviation Heritage Museum. He says this is located near Perth, Australia. It has a small collection of planes that played important roles in the RAF history. He said, I found a plane I had not heard of before, the MB-326H. And he says, although I'm sure David is aware of it, he says they also have a Lancaster bomber, which is in great condition. He has a few pictures. Maybe we'll put those in the show notes, and also a link to the museum, so you can check that out if that's some place that you may be able to visit.
Do we have time for just a couple of quick shout-outs to listeners that have done some nice things?
Yeah, sure, Rob. What do you have?
Well, I have two things. If folks go up to I know, shameless plug. If they go up to jetwine.com, they will see a brand new logo for the Aviation Minute that just went up this week. And it was designed by Ann Kirby, who is the sister of our friend, my true love. Well, so long as my wife doesn't find out. Mary Kirby. So Mary gave me the referral to Ann's graphic design company, and they did a really superb job, I think, of a new logo for the Aviation Minute. So you'll want to check that out.
I like this. I'm looking at it right now, Rob. It's that's really nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I just basically said I want this and that, and I kind of want people to be astounded when they see it. And everybody that I have shown it to so far just went, whoa, it's kind of cool. So that's one. And then also this week, you remember this guy, what's his name? Oh, he's so cranky. I can never remember his name.
Is he a flyer?
Brett. What's his name? Cranky something. Brett Snyder. You know, the cranky flyer. Yeah, he's also the cranky concierge.
Yes, yes.
And I had a dilemma. I honestly can't believe all the times I've flown. I never used him, but I did. And I had to go to Montreal next month for a conference at the ICAO headquarters. And getting from Chicago to Montreal is not easy. You wouldn't think it would be a big deal, but the flights are just, they're a mess. And I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to call the cranky concierge. Mm. And I'll bet it took him 40 minutes, and he had the problem solved with flights that worked for me at a price I could live with. And I went, whoa. And I think his fee was, I don't know, $50 or something like that. And I went, man, I just beat myself up about a month ago trying to book reservations for someplace else. And I got to tell you, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm using Cranky Concierge because it was really nice.
Yeah, we've heard from other listeners who've done the same thing with the same result. So that's great. Yeah, it's a good service.
All right. Well, that's the end of my shout outs to, and I did not receive any compensation for these product and service endorsements.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, John Cudahy. He's president of the International Council of Air Shows. You can visit their website at www.airshows.aero, A-E-R-O, of course. We also want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron, Steve Vischer, and ATC Ben. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. We look for Peter Johnson to return next week, but meantime, you can find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, Rob, why don't we tell folks where they can find you online?
Well, right here. Oh, okay. You meant besides right here. Okay, all right. Well, it's certainly jetwine.com and Jetwine on Twitter. And let's see, the Aviation Minute, which is a piece of the jetwine.com site. Also, AIN Safety, if you're a safety geek and you don't subscribe to this, it's free. You're goofy. So let me know and I'll get you the subscription information and various and sundry other places along social media lines.
Great. And we'll mention David Vanderhoof. You can find him at his blog, whatjustflewby.com. And on Twitter, he is DM Vanderhoof. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. Also, the UAVDigest.com, which is the podcast that I do with David, weekly podcast on drones and unmanned aerial vehicles and such. Also, you can find me at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the PaxX podcast, the Passenger Experience podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find full show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. Use the shortcut airplanegeeks.com/296 if you'd like a direct link there. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our Google Plus community. We're also on Stitcher.com. You can stream us to your mobile phone. And we're also on TuneIn.com. We like feedback. If you'd like to send us an email, send it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you have a recording that you've made, a little MP3 file or something, like you've heard this episode, you can send that to this same address, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. But we also have a listener line. If you want to leave us a very brief audio message, because it'll cut out after 3 minutes, I think, you can give us a call on that listener line. Aunt Benet, what can you tell us?
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. Oh, Mary Kirby, call me Mary. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, don't wait too long.